Children, we're starting.
That's right.
Showtime!
Another Fresh Picked Pod from audio2u.com. Shutters Inc. with Shelton Muller.
Might wish to stay on and listen.
Hi, and welcome to episode 112 of Shutters Inc. 2 weeks in a row. Mark it on the wall.
Oh, no, we missed last week.
Oh, did we?
Yeah.
Dull.
Yeah.
Well, there we go.
Well, and we almost missed this week.
It was a nice try.
With our, with our microphone problems. Yeah. Does anybody know, if you're out there and you're and you have any idea why my advanced controls for microphone would be ticking alternate microphone every 10 seconds by itself, let me know, would you? Because, you know, so far so good, but, you know, if I suddenly die, it's because my computer is deciding to tick alternate microphone. Good heavens.
Yeah, Shelton and I have been trying to troubleshoot this for the last 20 minutes, and, yep. I mean, you know, I'm reasonably good with computers, and I do not know why his machine is doing this. It just keeps on turning his microphone off. But it seems to be an intermittent problem. Like, it's not happening now.
Yeah.
And yet we've changed nothing.
Yeah.
It's just all of a sudden it's suddenly gone, oh, okay, you really wanted to use that microphone.
anyone would think it was human.
Or
female.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say it.
Yes, but, you know, I have the courage to say things you think that I say. You know, mate, it was lovely catching up with you when I came up to Sydney. You and Kathy and Max, and
likewise, it was
great. It was. Yeah, and thank you for a lovely Thai dinner.
Yeah, no worries.
It was really, really cool. We'll have to do that. We'll have to do that more often.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was really great. And what's been going on? I'll fill you in on mine in a minute. What's been going on in the world of Bruce Williams photography?
Oh, nothing. Nothing at all. I did, however, get the I remember I said I bought one of those, you know, cheapy off camera flash thingamajiggies through eBay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I bought one of those, and I naturally also at the same time bought the Minolta hot shoe adapter because of Minolta's proprietary hot shoe.
Yeah.
And so I mount that, you know, the Minolta hot shoe adapter thing on the top of my camera, and then I mount the sender part of the off-camera flash, you know, apparatus on top of that Minolta hot shoe adapter.
Yeah.
So that side of it's fine.
Yep.
But then the shoe of the flash unit won't connect to the receiver, again, because it's a Minolta mount. So it's almost like I need the inverse of the hot shoe adapter.
Sorry, what's happening? Give me that again.
Well, okay, Minolta have a unique mount, right?
Yeah.
And if we think
I've
of it,
got the adapter for it.
Yeah, but if you think of a hot shoe, you've got two sides to the equation. It's like an audio connector. You have a male and a female, a plug and a socket, right?
Yep.
So what I've got is the hot shoe adapter on the camera, so it's interfacing between the camera and the sender unit.
Yes.
Right, the unit which sends the remote signal.
Yep.
But then you've got the receiver portion of the off-camera flash apparatus, which which has, you know, like a hot shoe thing where the flash is supposed to connect.
Ah.
And I need some other sort of adapter to go in between those two.
Right, okay. But yeah, you need a generic flash. Yeah.
I see what you're saying. I can use any flash now.
You can use any flash now. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Mate, just head down to your local cash converters or secondhand store, and with 20 or 30 bucks in your hand, and go and buy yourself just any old flash.
Oh, cool.
Right.
I had been thinking to myself, I must ask Shelton about this because I'm sure he'll know. And there you go. Oh, that's cool. So that means, you can use any flash I like now.
Any flash you like now. Yeah, absolutely. Because there's no family relationship between the camera and the flash, basically, at this stage, because you've disconnected. They're off camera, right? So provided one triggers the other, it doesn't matter what camera and what flash you use.
Wow.
With that system, you're not getting TTL anyway.
No.
So, you know, if you're going to do off-camera flash, buy yourself, you know, I mean, if you can afford it, And I'm sure on your wage you can, if anybody can. Man, I sat in your sports car, man. I'll tell you what,
it's not that much of a sports car.
I talk about middle-age crisis, you know. I'll tell you what, everybody.
No, if it was middle-age crisis, mate, it would have been the Mazda 6 MPS.
And Kathy would be blonde. Yeah. But, mate, look, just head out and go down to your local camera store, see what they've got in the way of a nice secondhand flash. If they've got something like a Metz 45 CT5 or something, awesome, you know.
Yeah.
And you can do anything with that.
Hey,
so now,
question.
Now you're, yeah.
So now that I have this newfound freedom of being able to use any flash, what are the limitations with regards shutter sync speed?
Your top sync speed on your camera remains the same.
Right, okay.
So if it's on 250th, is it?
I think it's a 250th, yeah.
Okay, well, that would be the case.
Right.
You can't go any faster than that.
Right.
You know how sometimes with dedicated flashes, they have a really high speed, you know, Nikon have the FP high speed sync.
Yep.
You can't do that.
Right.
A generic flash or, you know, with off camera flash in that respect. So you're still getting a very high shutter speed, but that'll be your top, you know. But now, of course, you've got all sorts of options in other ways anyway. So,
right.
You know, the world's your oyster now. Mm-hmm. The world's your oyster. So actually, it's interesting that we launched straight into your, you know, your off camera flash things, because since we mentioned it last time on Shutters Inc., we've had, you know, several requests for more on the subject. And so I think we'll perhaps what we'll do, if it's okay with you, Bruce, is start we'll see how long our listeners want this to go on for, but maybe we can start just a small series on getting to the bottom of this.
Sure.
And as listeners interact with us and tell us what more they want to know or what they haven't perhaps completely understood, we'll just keep adding to it. So let's not say at the moment we're going to do a 3 or 5 part series. Basically, let's just keep adding to it each week, depending on interaction from everybody, and see what they need. For instance, your issue that you've just mentioned, you know, I wouldn't have had a clue that that was, you know, a question that you'd considered. So,
well, I guess it's one of those things, until you find yourself in that position, you know, there's just so many variables that you couldn't imagine them all.
Yeah, you don't know, you know. So from that perspective, it's a perfect idea to keep it going. And in that respect, I've got this email here from Ian Reed. Shelton, I tried to send this to you via audio to you, but it bounced. Okay, but I got it, Ian. That's because you sent it to my personal address. That's fine. No worries. Something must have gone wrong there, Bruce, anyway.
Okay.
And he says, wow, what a great show, followed by 78 exclamation marks. He says, talk about find the light. For me, the light finally came on halfway through the podcast. I had tried the off-camera flash, but the exposure, in capital letters, was always the problem. Somehow I'd never put it all together the way you did in the podcast. Now I'm beginning to get my head around the exposure issues with flash. I suppose digital has made us lazy in that the exposure has always been the easy part. With off-camera flash, we are getting back to exposure basics again. I, for one, will be one very happy camper if we were to pursue the off-camera flash in a series of podcasts. And as I say, Ian, it's really your and other emails that's inspiring me to do this, so thank you for the suggestion. I have one of those cheap Chinese triggers. Bruce, mine can be triggered by putting it in the hot shoe or by plugging it into my Canon 30D. This way you can have it fire with or without the on-camera flash. Okay, did you get that, Bruce?
Yeah, I'm listening, I'm thinking. Okay. Yep.
Good. This week, I'm off to buy an STE2 trigger for the Canon so I can get TTL. Good on you, Ian. Inspiration has its budgetary consequences. Thanks, Shelton. P.S. Use this note if it's any of value to you. 2. I see you are intending to run flash workshops. I'll be very interested. Keep me posted. Well, yep. Will, Ian, you can be absolutely sure of that. So that's one. And then, of course, we have Mark Loader. Now, you'd remember Mark.
Yes. Right? This is the guy from Perth, right?
Yeah. he says, hey, Nails, I hope you and Bruce are both hale and hearty. Shudder's ink is like a great winter soup. You are the broth, and Bruce is the crusty bread.
I'm not sure how to take that.
I don't know either. Pretty crusty too, let me tell you. God is in heaven, the cats are winning, and Nikon have announced a new camera, and we are going to talk about that. Ain't life grand? Canon have announced a new camera as well, but who gives a rat's clapper? No. Now, for those who... shall we explain that expression for those who are not Australian?
Let's not. Okay.
No doubt it will still produce woolly JPEGs, which will keep the uncircumcised Philistines busy in Photoshop hell. Let them amuse themselves with the vile abomination, while we, the chosen, rejoice over the D700. So, are you going to get one, or what? Do you need to get one, given the excellence of the D300? Does the full frame limit your lens choices? So far, I've only heard of two zooms for the D3, the 24-72.8 and the 14-24 2.8. Is this correct? And if Nikon put on a Pacific cruise for the launch, can I come too? I won't tell your wife and my wife, that is she who must be obeyed, who doesn't know where you live. Just think about it, okay? Anyway, I'll leave with a gripe. Remember that great woman shutterbug I mentioned on Flickr, Lucy DeBelka? She chose her current camera, a Pentax K20D, over the D300 because it had a higher megapixel count. Surely we're past that now. As always, out there, the only one who truly loves you, Mark Loader, Perth, Western Australia. Mark, gotta admit, love your emails. First of all, we are going to talk about the D700. To answer your questions, yes, I am going to get one or what. I am going to get one or what. Do you need to get one, given the excellence of the D300? Well, the reason that I want the D700, Mark, is because it has the D3 sensor in it, which, you know, all right, it's what they call the full frame or 35mm size, or Nikon call the FX size sensor. But it's more than that. What I really love about the sensor in the D3 was, A, its skin tones, which the D300 does beautifully as well, but the D3 has just beautiful skin tones and just such an excellent dynamic range. But in speaking with Craig Gillespie here at Nikon Australia and others at Nikon Australia, most photographers who shoot with the D3 set the ISO at around 800 as their starting point.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and that's because at 800 they don't see any noise.
Wow.
Now that's got to mean something, say, for the portrait, wedding, you know, available light photographer, someone like myself who likes to find the light and put them in it, you know.
Yeah.
If 800 is your starting point, I don't know that I'll do that, but hey, I'll soon find out when I get one.
So what's its highest ISO rating?
Oh, look.
Is it 6400 or?
Something, excuse me, something like that.
Wow.
And I saw a 30x40-inch print shot at 6400 ISO.
Whoa.
And I had to walk right up to it before I saw any noise.
At so 30 standing, by 40 inch?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like I had to walk up to it like a foot away before I saw, oh yeah, there's a bit of noise in that. But I mean, it like at standard viewing distance, I couldn't see anything that would concern me.
Wow.
And the dynamic range, even at that high ISO rating, was...
So right about now, you're probably wondering what just happened to the podcast. Well, it is now 7:15 on Sunday evening. The first 13 minutes of this podcast, which you've just been listening to, was recorded yesterday morning. Now, what happened was I had a massive power outage here at my house, and Shelton and I were actually 35 minutes into the podcast, but it's only the first 13 minutes that was actually salvageable. The rest of the audio got corrupted. So,
yes.
We're going to pick up from the end of that piece of audio from yesterday, and if we happen to, you know, cover something that we've already covered in the first 13 minutes of this podcast, then please forgive us. It's because we don't know what we have covered and haven't covered, so we're just going to pick it up from where we left off, aren't we, mate?
We're going to wing it. We're going to do our best. And you know what? I'm giving up my Sunday evening, as are you,
yeah.
Right? So if there's any complaints, I'm sorry. They will not be listened to.
That's it.
Absolutely tough. So
you're talking about 30x40-inch print.
Yeah.
Shot at what? 6400?
Shot at 6400 ISO. I know the photographer personally, and it is incredible. Yeah. Now, of course, you have to. There was noise, but the thing is, it took me quite a bit of walking up to the print to see the noise.
Right.
And that's fine by me. I mean, I was only a couple of feet away from a 30x40 inch print before I started to see a bit of noise. Now, no, you don't normally look at a 30x40 inch print from 2 feet away.
No.
You look at it from 10 feet away, yeah, so you're not going to see anything. And the most important thing is he got the picture.
Yeah.
At 6400 ISO available light, it was a late night rodeo photograph.
Wow.
Or a rodeo photograph, depending on whether you're American, Canadian, Australian, or whatever.
Yeah.
But it was just a great, a really fantastic way to be able to take photographs. And while we've been able to in times past, you've got, in film you had grain the size of golf balls.
Yeah.
And in digital you've had noise that just makes the picture, so full of randomly colored pixels. It's quite awful.
Mm-hmm.
So getting back to, Mark's email, which of course we were discussing yesterday before we had the power out, and of course we'd well and truly gone past that, but one of the reasons that this sensor that they've got in the D3 and the D700, that's really the reason you want it, is the incredible dynamic range of it, the high noise capability. If you're a guy who finds the light and puts them in it, then this is a great camera, as is the D3, because they have such incredible high, noise or a low noise, high ISO capability.
Yep.
That you think, wow, Now, Mark goes on to say, look, what about the lens situation? Does full frame, he says, limit your lens choices? He says, so far I've only heard of two zooms for the D3, the 24-70 2.8 and the 14-24 2.8. Is this correct? Well, they are two new lenses for the Nikon, but you can use any Nikon lens on them. And in fact, you can even use a DX size, a DX lens on the D3 and the D700. You've just got to adapt it correctly or let the camera know, and it will crop the sensor. But any lens is just basically what it is. It's going to have a slight magnification change if it's, or 50% magnification change if it's the full frame, if we want to use that expression, sensor.
Yep.
As against a DX or a APS-C size sensor that will give you, greater magnification at telephoto. However, if you're a landscape shooter, then you've got the ability of saying, well, here's my 20mm, and it's a 20mm again. It's not a 30mm, or 30mm equivalent. So you've got advantages and disadvantages both ways. I am a people shooter by and large, so I'm not really going to have too much of a concern. My 85 will be a little shorter than I'm used to seeing it, but I've got my, that's fine. I used to use it with film and still loved it.
I was going to say, even 85... At a true 85,
yeah.
F 1.7, is it?
1.8, yeah.
1.8, yeah. I mean, that's...
It's still gorgeous.
Still a kick-ass lens.
Exactly. And, the other thing, when I was using the D3, when I was running a workshop, one of the fellas threw me a D3, and I played with that all day. I used my 180 a fair bit.
Right.
And it was my 180 2.8, and I loved it. So, really, it's just horses for courses, and it's really not too much of a worry. Mark goes on to then, change subjects. So let's just say for now that the D700 is an awesome piece of gear. If you're in Melbourne and you want to be there for the pre-launch of the D700, I am personally taking care of that pre-launch as per Nikon's request, and I'll be there to, be part of the launch for the D700 at Camera Action in Lonsdale Street in Melbourne.
Nice.
So if that's on Thursday night of the 24th from 6:30 p.m. through to about 10:30. So if you want to come down and play with the camera, have a look at it, and check it out, we're doing the pre-launch there. So anyway, anyone in Melbourne or Australia who wants to come, you're more than welcome. So getting off the D700, which I could talk about for a long time to come, let's continue on. He said, by the way, this is Mark's email, I think.
Yeah.
We're still on this subject, if I remember our recording yesterday.
Right.
He says, anyway, I'll leave you with a gripe. Remember that great woman shutterbug I mentioned on Flickr? Her name is Lucy DeBelka. She chose her current camera, a Pentax K20D, over the D300 because it had a higher megapixel count. Surely we're past that now. As always, out there, the only one who truly loves you, Mark Loader. Right, well, yes, she was a silly girl for doing so, unless, of course, she has already got into the Pentax system and has lenses for it, etc., etc. Whereas that makes sense. The Pentax K20D is a lovely camera, and they do take great pictures. However, if she was just choosing on a system and she had an open slather, as it were, she was carte blanche, then she went the wrong way, quite seriously. And I'm not saying that because I'm a Nikon devotee. I'm saying that because the D300 is a better camera. And it has been reviewed as by magazines, by websites, to say this is the best camera in its class in the world right now, no questions asked. So, you know, there you go. I agree with you, Mark. If the megapixel count was her reason, then, you know, it was not the wisest choice. Not a well-informed choice, if that was her only reason, because the difference between them two is minimal, and that kind of difference ain't worth talking about. There's a lot more to the quality of an image than just how many pixels up and how many pixels across.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with you, Mark. Silly decision if that was her only reason for doing so. But now, I can't remember from yesterday, because we just you know, blathered on like we normally do, whether I'd really gone through Ian Reed's email. I think his was the first we read.
I think it was, yeah. I think what we were then going to do was move on to, you know, more discussion of off-camera flash.
Absolutely, and that we did. So I'm just trying to fix that segue here, Bruce. I'm trying to make it all smooth. So
behind me.
Yeah, I reckon you're right. I reckon you're right. But in Ian's email, he says, look, talk about, you know, find the light. For me, the light finally came on halfway through the podcast. I had tried the off-camera flash, but the exposure, in capital letters, was always the problem. Somehow I'd never put it all together the way you did in the podcast. Now I'm beginning to get my head around the exposure issues with flash. I suppose digital, and this is the key point, I suppose digital has made us lazy in that the exposure has always been the easy part. With off-camera flash, we're getting back to exposure basics again. I, for one, will be one very happy camper if we were to pursue the off-camera flash in a series of podcasts. And that's what we're going to do. He says, I have one of those cheap Chinese triggers. Bruce, mine can be triggered by putting it in the hot shoe or by plugging it into my Canon 30D. So he's talking about using the sync lead, the PC. In this way, you can fire it with or without the on-camera flash. This week, I'm off to buy an ST-E2 trigger for the Canon so I can get TTL. Inspiration has its budgetary consequences. Thanks, Shelton, Ian Reed. So let's get back to, let's pretend that you and all our listeners are using generic camera, right? You're using a Shelton Flex DSLR, and you've got a Brucelite generic flash, right?
Yep.
So there's no connection between the two. You've got a camera, a digital SLR camera, the Shelton Flex, and you've got a Brucelite flash, right? Now, how do you make the two work together? Well, first of all, we all understand how the exposure in the camera works. So let's just say, for instance, that we're going to take a picture of a person in a scene. We would say, okay, we embark upon this photograph by making the decision that we are going to use flash, and that decision will be the next decision we make, rather, will be, well, how much flash do I want to actually have apparent in the image? And depending on the answer to that question, we really start to have to think about exposure. And Ian says, you know, that really using off-camera flash, we're getting back to exposure basics again. But what has always happened, he says, I had tried the off-camera flash, but the exposure was always the problem. Now, that can be a problem two ways, because if we're using, say, a TTL system, like the Nikon CLS system, or the Canon ST-E2 trigger with, you know, its off-camera flash, the 580EX, or whatever flash, the 430 or the 580, you are going to basically be saying to the camera, you'd make the decision. And it will meter for the scene, and it will tell the flash to add as much flash as is required, but no more. Now, if the camera is metering for the scene, the camera will meter for the scene as correctly as possible, meaning that the flash may not actually have a lot of work to do, depending on where you've positioned it and what you want it to fill, depending on where the main light source is, whether your subject is silhouetted or not, etc., etc. And in this particular case, I just want to refer to the video that I remember talking about this in the podcast we recorded yesterday that was corrupted.
Yeah.
On the Audio to You website, Bruce, you've got two links that were given to us by one of our devoted listeners.
Mm-hmm.
And the first video is a Joe McNally video of a shoot that he does in the desert with three people,
outside
right?
Dubai, yeah.
Is it outside Dubai, is it? Mm. Well, he's got a belly dancer, no, a showgirl, a
That one is done outside Las Vegas.
I thought so, yeah.
But the other one is outside Dubai.
Right, okay. In the one outside Las Vegas, he's in the desert, and he's got a magician, a contortionist, and a showgirl.
Mm.
And he's shooting basically into the sun with them, you know, silhouetted, you might say. And he says that he uses the camera on AI. I suggest everybody go to audiotu.com and click on these links that Bruce has kindly put on there, because he's, you know, and watch this video, because it's very enlightening, yeah. No pun intended.
They're half-hour videos. Like, they're like a whole show.
Yeah.
They're great.
Yeah, it is, and there's a lot to be learned, especially if you're a CLS user, you know, a Nikon CLS user. But just the way he actually manipulates the flash, positions the flash, diffuses the flash, uses multiple flashes, a lot to be learned in that video. So from that, you know, particular perspective alone, just watch it. But the interesting thing is that he points his camera directly into the sun. So automatically you've got a situation whereby the camera's going to go, gee, it's very bright in here, and sort of close everything down. To compensate for that, he uses the whole system on auto, and he has the Nikon CLS fill in the flash so that the person is not silhouetted by the sun, but, you know, is lit up by the flash. So he gets this beautiful sort of darkish landscape with the flash blasting away to light up this silhouette. However, if he had changed and was shooting away from the sun, and he'd had the subject lit by the sun, and the sun was to his back, and used the same method, in other words, leaving the camera on aperture priority automatic, or A, and shooting, you know, with a flash, just pure TTL, the flash would have had a lot less work to do, because it wouldn't have had to fill in a silhouette. The subject would have been lit by the sun, and the camera flash, the off-camera flash, would have just filled in a little bit, would have become more of a fill light rather than an actual kill key light. So, you know, the way that he was shooting that made a lot of difference. Let's now say that you're in the same situation and you don't have a CLS or a TTL sort of system with you. That being the case, how would you manage your exposure? So you've got a Shelton Flex DSLR and a Brusalite flash. All right. Well, the first thing you got to do is, like we've said, decide what level of flash and what level of exposure do you want. In other words, do you want the flash to have a lot more impact on the image than the ambient light? Or do you want it just to fill? Now, let's say, for instance, you want to just have the flash fill a little bit. Okay, let's start at scenario one, and let's start at base one. The first thing you have to know is probably, so that you can do this, is how to set up your system. My suggestion would be, and this is from experience, and there would be a million other ways you could do this, but this is the way that works for me. Set your camera on M. And set the exposure manually. Set the exposure as per what your meter says. And you will maybe come up with an exposure of, I don't know, let's just say for fun, f8 at 125th of a second, right? Now, that might be the exposure. However, the thing we have to remember is that you're using flash here, and the flash will change, especially if you've set the flash up on manual as well. The flash will change your f-stop setting, and so you may have a bit of an issue here. Now, you need to know the guide number of your flash, and so that you can put it on manual and just let it blast away. Because there is no talking from the camera to the flash, you have a situation whereby you have to set up everything manually. The guide number is exactly that. A guide number is a number that comes with your flash basically to help you make calculations so that you can expose correctly. When flash first became, you know, a very important part of photography, photographers had, you know, those screw-in bulb flashes. And what they would do would be to, you know, they would do an instant math using their guide number, knowing the guide number of these bulbs. The guide number is the number you use to make your calculations for the aperture setting. So, let's have a look at a couple of flashes that are available at the moment. The strobists use the flash that I have known since I was a teenager, the Vivitar 285. This is a great flash. It has, you know, a manual setting. It has a half, quarter, eighth, 16th power. I think it goes to a 16 power, and you can control the manual output of it. That's very, very handy. Another excellent flash that's been around for a long time that's generic and packs a real punch and is very versatile is the Metz 45 series of flashes. They are excellent flashes that you could use off-camera as well. Let's just talk about the Vivitar 285 as just an example flash, right? We'll call it our Bruce-a-lite flash. The guide number of that is the guide number of most flash guns is usually found in their model number. So in the Vivitar 285, it has a guide number of 28. What does that guide number mean? Well, it helps us at the starting point of our math. The math is guide number divided by distance equals f-stop. Let me say that again. Guide number divided by distance equals f-stop. So, let's say your guide number for your flash, as is the case with the Vivitar 285, is 28 in meters at 100 ISO. Okay? That's the way they usually set this up. 28 in meters at 100 ISO. I was explaining this to a workshop recently, students in a workshop, and a hand went up immediately. And the hand basically said, look, does that mean that the flash will fire for 28 meters? And I said, yes, but you might have to have an F1 lens in order for it to do that, because it's a guide number to help you with the math. And the math is guide number divided by distance equals f-stop. So let's say, your guide number is 28. Now your subject is, let's say, 4 meters away. Okay, 4 meters away. Well, if you divide 28 by 4, you come up with 7. So that tells you that if you are set at 100 ISO, you're using a flash with a guide number of 28 in meters at 100 ISO, and your subject is 4 meters away. Your f-stop will be 7. It's close enough. Let's say 8 for the sake of this experiment, right? Because we know mm-hmm. F8 pretty well. All right?
Yep.
So you're suddenly finding that you've got an aperture setting on full manual. You've got your Vivitar 285 at full manual. That tells you what aperture setting to set it on. Now, because you're off camera, you can put your flash however far or however close you want to your subject.
Can I just interject?
Yeah, absolutely.
What about your shutter speed?
There, we'll get to that.
Okay.
The shutter speed and the aperture interplay is going to make all the difference into how much or how apparent your flash is going to be.
Right.
Right? Now, I said earlier that we've metered for the scene, and we've metered for it at F8 at 125th of a second at 100 ISO.
Oh, okay.
All right?
Yep.
Now, let's say that you've set your flash 4 meters approximately from your subject so that you get that F8. Okay, knowing the guide number, and you've done your math, and in order to get F8, you've brought your flash 4 meters away. You might want to change that for effect, but your flash distance to subject has to match up if that's the aperture you want to work on. Okay, so let's fire away. We've got our camera at F8 at 125th, which is the accurate ambient exposure for that scene. We've set the flash up at 4 meters away approximately, so that we've got around about an F8, right? Pretty close to F7 is close enough. Not a huge difference. Well, you'd fire away, and you'd probably notice that while the flash made some difference, it didn't actually make a heck of a lot of difference, because it's the distance and the ambient, the distance of flash to subject is F8, but your ambient exposure is F8 anyway. So you may find, unless of course it's a backlit subject and it's dark, that it may not make a heck of a lot of difference. Now, of course, what do you want to do? Are you happy with that? You can usually tell on the back of the screen. But what you can do is really start to play with the exposure now. If, like you said, Bruce, what if I was to now change the exposure to F8 at 1/250th of a second? What I've done is I've brought my ambient exposure down one stop, so it will technically be one stop under. The shot will be one stop under exposed, but my flash, which is set for correct exposure, will fill in any of the problems on the subject. Maybe not for the rest of the scene, because the rest of the scene might be a landscape, a desert, like Joe McNally's DVD, right? But it will fill in the subject a lot more. because we've underexposed everything else. The flash now is going to become the primary light.
But won't the exposure on the subject change as well?
Yes, it would if we weren't using flash.
No, but I mean even with flash. Won't
depend.
Like the way I'm thinking, and I'm love to be corrected if I'm thinking it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got correct shutter speed and aperture, and you've done your maths with your guide number, so mm-hmm. that you get your subject exposed exactly the way you wanted them to be exposed with the flash.
Yep.
And you then take another shot where you double the shutter speed,
mm-hmm.
then surely you have affected how much light is getting back down the barrel of the lens to the film plane or the sensor.
You're only affecting the ambient light.
Really?
You're only affecting the ambient light because the flash doesn't give a damn what shutter speed you use, provided you synchronize. The flash is firing at 1,000th, 5,000th, 10,000th of a second. Because the flash, the guide number, is all about aperture.
Right.
Now, so because we've set the aperture correctly, right, what we've done to make the flash more apparent in the photograph and make the subject stand out a little more even is light is underexposed the ambient by a full stop,
yep.
which is, right, another, like, 1/250th of a second. But now, because the flash is still at the same aperture, it's going to throw the same amount of light on the subject as it did in the previous one, but it's going to have more of an effect because everything else is underexposed. In the previous example, f8 at 1/125th of a second, which is, according to the camera, the correct exposure,
mm-hmm.
the flash isn't going to be as apparent as it would in the second one, because the ambient light is also making up for all, burning in on the sensor or on the film, and the flash is just coming in as a supplementary or an equal, at the very best, an equal. But if I now underexpose by means of the shutter speed, I'm letting half as much light in, the flash is still going to fire the same amount of light. But because everything else is underexposed, it will actually be doing the same amount of work but having a greater impact on the image. Because it's lighting up the image more in the sense that everything else is underexposed. There's not as much ambient light to fill in as it did in the previous exposure. So therein is the way that you can start to play with that. If you were to move your flash backward and forward and alter those combinations, you start to get an idea of how much fun you can have with off-camera flash, distance, and ambient exposure. With TTL systems, you basically you can have a lot more fun with that because you can tell your flash to, like I said in the last podcast, that you can basically fool your flash into thinking you're the idiot and it has to do a lot more work. Really, all you're doing is taking the control. With the Nikon CLS system, I use my camera mainly manually, because I want to be able to control how much effect the flash has on the photograph. Because if I'm using off-camera flash, there's some reason that I'm doing that. And usually it's because I want the flash to be very apparent. I want it to cast a shadow a certain way. I want it to form the subject and shape the subject a certain way. If my ambient light matches the flash, there's not going to be that much difference. But if I've underexposed the rest of the image, the flash now becomes the primary light source, not the ambient light. And it is going to be the thing casting the shadows. It's going to be the thing shaping and forming my subject, not the ambient light with the flash as sort of a fill. It's a completely different way of working it. And so it's all about really, especially in the case of, your generic Shelton Flex and Brusalite flash, in the case of that, you've got basically the rules of math to go by, and if you get to know them and you understand them, you move your flash, you change your aperture, you change your shutter speed to vary the effect. So there's nothing you can't do with one of these $30 triggers, a $30 flash, and your DSLR if you know how to set it up.
Well, I must say you've got me thinking in a whole new way now, because
cool.
I didn't realize that, as mentioned previously, that, you know, the altering of the shutter speed would not affect the flash. I just assumed that it would.
Yeah, no, it only in the case of, say, a through the lens system, it would.
Yeah.
Because especially if you've, you know, deliberately underexposed or whatever. Now the only, but in a case of, say, using a manual flash set on manual, it's giving the same burst each time.
Yep.
Because it's the only thing that it, the guide number gives you is the f-stop. Then the f-stop is your non-variable, right? Yeah. Depending on how, but you can vary that, of course, by simply moving the flash back and forward from the subject.
Or going to half power and quarter power and so on.
Bingo, yeah. You can, if you can dial down the flash, you can go to half, quarter, eighth, 16th, whatever it gives you. That's excellent. With a CLS system, a TTL system like the Nikon, the Canon, you can basically underexpose with shutter speed and aperture, because it's a different way of talking, right? They talk to each other differently.
Yep.
And yes, it does make a difference. Now, just don't go over and above, of course, your synchronization speed, but that's a different set of circumstances, and the understanding of the principle will help you to work that out for yourself. But I suppose the point is that, and this is what, you know, Ian Reed is saying in his email, I'd tried the off-camera flash, but the exposure was always the problem. Now, I've seen that firsthand in running the workshops, that I've told my class, okay, I've set up the model, and I've said, okay, everybody, put your camera on 100 ISO, and set it at f4.5 at a 60th, which was the ambient exposure, right? It was a pretty sort of dull gray day, which was great for a flash workshop. And I said, okay, what I want you to do is take, just stand in a line, come up here, and take your, you know, and I had the flash set up so that it would expose, you know, at 4.5. I had, you know, a Vivitar 285 set up, and I'd made sure that it was set up so that f4 or 4.5 was the accurate aperture, and a 60th of a second was the correct shutter speed to get a proper ambient exposure. So I said, okay, take this picture. And they went, click, okay, and have a look. Now, the flash had an effect, but it didn't have a lot of effect, right? The flash was set off to, you know, camera left and sort of illuminated the model from the side. I had the model sort of turn and look slightly into the flash so that it would, the light would fall across her face. I said, okay, so that's at a 60th of a second. We're not going to change the aperture for reasons I've explained. But what happens now if you go to a 125th? Take that picture. And they did. Okay, what happens now if you go to a 1/250th and take that picture? And each time, they could see that they had less ambient light. And even though the flash was emitting the same amount of light, because they'd underexposed everything else by a stop and then by two stops, they could see that they were changing the impact of the flash and its light as a source, and making it more apparent. And instead of just becoming a fill light, now it's actually becoming the key light, the main light. And so you can control exactly how much impact that flash has in your image by altering your ambient exposure and letting the flash do the rest. In either case, whether it's TTL or whether you're working with, you know, a generic camera, generic flash, you can alter the impact of your flash in its, you know, in your photograph by simply playing with your ambient exposure and not doing a damn thing with the flash. And by that, you can get very, very powerful flash images in circumstances like that. You need to decide before you take the photograph, or during the process, either way, which of these you're going to be, you know, what are you going to want? You're going to want a natural look, or you're going to want something really dynamic with the flash. And it's by understanding how the flash calculation is made in terms of your guide number resulting in your aperture that you can then start to think about your combinations and the principles of it and work from there. So that is why it's a good idea not always to work with, you know, manual, as it were, auto and TTL, but play with the manual exposure on the camera and, you know, your flash, whether it be TTL or some other generic flash. It really, if you understand the principles of it, it doesn't make any difference at all. You can get exactly the same effect, just one will take you a little bit longer than the other because you got to work it out. But after a while, those maths just, you know, become
second nature.
They do. Yep. The photographers in the 40s and the 50s who had those, you know, bulbs that they used to screw in, take one picture and throw on the floor, they knew that the guide number of that bulb was this particular, you know, whatever number. And they would immediately look at the scene, do a gut meter of it, because they didn't have inbuilt meters in their cameras in those days.
No.
Right? So they'd say, oh, okay, we're outside. It's F8 at 125th, but of course my flash is F5.6, so that'll mean it's 250th. So, and they would do that all in their head. And then they would say, well, but I don't really want the flash to register that much, so I actually will make it F8 at 125th instead of F5.6, and that way the flash won't have as much effect. So they knew all this thing, and they did this math in their head just quickly. And they covered sporting events, and, you know, they were quick. They were thinking, man, on their feet. And they had these big 4x5 Graflexes and all sorts of things. These guys were brilliant at what they did. But they understood it. So off-camera flash has been around for decades. But it's, you know, it's only in recent times it's had this resurgence because of the off-camera flash technologies that have, you know, come about and made life, you know, a lot less difficult, because we've had, you know, wireless and, you know, infrared and TTL and all those things. We haven't had to run leads and all that kind of thing. So it really is a great way to start thinking about using light in circumstances where, you know, it might be rather dull. As I was saying, you know, I've uploaded to my Flickr site an image that I took, and I think I mentioned it in our last podcast, in this grey Melbourne day that had no light whatsoever. It was soft and lovely, but there was nothing really dynamic about it, and I wanted some rim lighting. So I just got Nathan, my do-it-yourself carbon-based voice-activated light stand, to my son to stand off with the flash just behind the subject, and bang, I underexposed the scene by one stop, made the flash work a little bit harder, and I didn't underexpose by one stop. No, I'm sorry. I exposed the scene correctly because I wanted the light on their face to be right, but I set the flash to overexpose by one stop from the camera. I set it to overexpose one stop so that it would give me this real powerful backlight, this real powerful, you know, and it worked.
Right.
So, you know, you can be in a situation where you can make it look natural or make it look quite unnatural, depending on what you want to do. Either way, there are I would suggest that you get yourself a model, you know, your husband, your wife, your child, you know, whatever you want. Put them in a situation that, like an ambient light situation, you've got a fair bit of play in. Set up your flash and just take some test shots and see the differences between what happens when you've set it to match the ambient correctly, and then what happens when you underexpose a stop, two stops, etc., etc., to see the difference between what the flash can do in an image and, you know, when you have it and when you don't have it. So that's just a matter of exposure. And if we still have any questions after this, by all means, we can talk about this and go over it next week if there's still an issue. On 5 Minute Photographer, I have a 5 Minute video that talks about flash and exposure and runs through that whole guide number equation. So you can have a look at that if you like, if you're a member. And so that will help you. But again, send me an email if you found that I've been blathering on and not explaining myself particularly well. In future podcasts, because Ian's was not the only request for a series of podcasts on off-camera flash, we're going to be talking about using color temperature and white balance to alter what impact your flash has on your image. We'll also be talking about using the flash and positioning it in accordance with the available light you have and the subject. And we'll also be talking about how to get your subject to interact with that light source so that you get the most effect, particularly, of course, if your, you know, subject is a human being. So for wedding photography, portrait photography, swimsuit photography, any of those things where you might want to use off-camera flash, how do you make the flash work for the benefit of your subject in terms of shape and form and texture and emotion and all those things? There's still a heck of a lot we can discuss in taking your flash off camera. And so we'll be doing that starting next week and in the weeks to come. But I say, like I say, you know, there's no need for us to say, look, we're going to do 6 podcasts on this. We'll just keep doing it until we stop getting emails and people saying, okay, we've got it, Shelton. We've got it. We understand. Enough already. We've got it. And then we'll say, okay, time to move on. And so, look, if you really didn't understand what I was talking about today, please send me an email and we can go over it again just briefly in the next podcast. If you have questions or examples that I haven't thought of, that I haven't come up with, just let me know and I can answer those questions. If you've got a hypothetical, for instance, send me an email with that hypothetical written down. We'll talk about it. I'll read the email on air on a podcast, mm-hmm. yep. and we'll say, okay, good question. Well, this, getting back to our principles, this is what we would do. Well, this is what you could do. Yeah.
Likewise, if you've got a shot that you tried and it didn't work the way you thought it should have,
yep.
Send us the details of what you took, you know, what ISO, what shutter speed, what aperture, what guide number your flash is, how far the flash was from the subject, you know, and I'm sure Shelton will just look at the numbers and go, yeah, well, I can see where you went wrong.
Yeah, like, I hope so. I certainly will do. I think it's a great idea. That's a great idea. And, of course, conversely, if you've taken a really awesome off-camera flash photo,
yeah,
let
absolutely.
Us know those details as well. I've always believed that we learn from our successes in photography and not from our mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you've got a successful photograph, send us it. And if you don't mind us posting it up on AudioTU and Shutter's Inc., the Flickr site or something, you do that yourself, we'd love to see it. But absolutely. Always, if you're in a hypothetical that I haven't considered in terms of the principles here, please let me know and we can talk about it. This is a great subject and it is a whole new way of, well, not finding the light and putting him in it, but making the light and putting him in it. And we've understood enough about finding the light and what it does. What if we had the complete control of making that light? You know, and creating the effect that we want. Well, you can. You put your flash on a stand or a tripod, and you can make whatever kind of light you want if you understand how light works and how your flash works, and away you go. The rest is just up to your imagination. Mm. So we've got a lot to talk about over, you know, the next few podcasts, so that by the end of it, you're having so much fun with your flash that you just don't want to stop using the thing. And you can, as we've said, make the effect profound or subtle. Understanding the exposure of it all is really at the key. So like I say, again, if we haven't gone through that enough, please let us know.
Absolutely. Mate, thank you very much.
That's my pleasure.
I've got to say, like, you know, when I'm edit these podcasts, I generally don't listen to the entire thing back. I sort of scan through because I can look at the waveform and I can see where I need to edit stuff out and whatnot. But this is going to be an episode I will be listening back to from start
okay.
to end. I really,
okay.
Because, you know, and I, you know, I'll go out on a limb here and say I'll guarantee that there's a whole bunch of our listeners who are in the same boat as me. They already understand ISO, aperture, shutter speed. They understand about getting a good exposure with natural light, whether that natural light be sunlight or, you know, tungsten light or fluorescent light or whatever. But, you know, certainly for me, flash has always been that sort of black art that I've never really understood.
It's a good description.
Some stuff you've touched on today that, like I said, has really got me thinking in a different way about it. So I'll definitely be listening back to this one right through.
Yeah. Well, I will try and
practicing too.
Yeah, I will try and remember, and I know I've said so before and completely been bound up with so many things I've had to do and I've forgotten to email you pictures, but I'll go through my flash workshop pictures and send you some off-camera flash stuff that I've done.
Okay.
And I think I have an example of ambient with flash, you know, like set
right.
correctly, ambient exposure with flash, Nikon CLS, of course.
Yep.
And then underexposed manual with flash. So, like, for instance, as we said, let's say the exposure was f8 at 125th. Well, I've done that, and I've told the flash just, yeah, give me what you got, whatever you decide. That's what the Nikon way, right? And then I've set the camera on manual, deliberately underexposed a couple of stops, and said to the flash, yeah, give me what you got, you know, whatever you decide. And the difference between the two is quite incredible in terms of how the flash impacts upon that image and changes its dynamics completely.
Yeah, right.
So I'll try and remember if I can find those. I think I've got photographs from my last workshop whereby I did that experiment. I should have something there to upload so you can see the difference. Okay.
All right. Excellent. I look forward to the next one.
Well, we'll see if we can do it, you know, without as much power. What happened, actually, just to sort of fill you in, gang, is that Bruce has so much computer and sound equipment that he just broke down Sydney's electrical grid. The whole city just, right? And, you know, he's had to sort of rework his computers and stuff so Sydney can get up and running again. So, you know, we managed to get this podcast done. And it's like I said, like Bruce said, sorry if we repeated anything that, you know. But there you have it. We're doing our best here, gang. We're doing our best.
Some of the information's better than no information.
Repetition for emphasis.
That's it. Excellent. All right, mate. Well, thank you for that.
My pleasure.
And we'll talk with you again next week, hopefully.
Looking forward to it. Yep.
All right, mate. See ya.
Good on you, mate. Thanks. See ya.
Now, how much of that did you understand?
Audio to You delivers the best quality podcasts direct to your desktop or portable. You be the boss. Hear what you want to hear.
When you want to hear.
Hit us today. And remember, Control D to bookmark. AudioToYou.com.
It's all over, Marge. It's all over.